mentioned, we're going to be in Micah, so would you turn there, please, if you've got your Bibles with you. Ron said that there's nothing easy about Advent, and in some ways, there's nothing easy about Micah either. When I announced a couple of weeks ago that we are going to be looking at Micah, I got all of these smiles and nods like, yeah, Micah. Man, I don't know what you guys were thinking. Micah. I think when you say you're going to do a prophet, go through a prophet, it's got kind of that cool factor, right? Prophets, wow. Talking about justice and vague future things maybe or something like that. But prophets have an unexpected punch, and it's usually received by the people who need it the most and are expecting it the least. So that might be us today. So, and I have taken a few on the chin this week, so I might deliver a few this morning, but it'll be, again, to myself. I'll be preaching to myself. You're welcome to listen along, follow along with that. Let me give you a couple of tips for reading our passage, and then we're going to jump right into it. The period of time we are talking about is before the exile. It's between basically Solomon, you know, David, then Solomon, and so between Solomon and the exile, we're sort of right in the middle of that time period, around the time of King Hezekiah, kings before him and king after him. So if that means anything to you, that might help you a little bit. At this point, could you go to the next slide, please, Olivia? At this point, there are going to be two kingdoms at play. Northern kingdom, typically called Israel, its capital is Samaria. Southern kingdom, known as Judah, its capital is obviously Jerusalem, that also is known as Zion. In this passage, you're going to find that there's confusing language because the prophet will refer to Israel sometimes as Jacob as well. And other prophets, they might refer to the northern kingdom of Israel as Ephraim. Here, it's just going to be Israel or Jacob. But confusingly, as the passage goes along, it will then refer to Judah as Jacob or Judah as Israel. And the reason for that is because the prophet is moving through time periods. And once the northern kingdom of Israel is destroyed, they start using the language of Israel and Jacob just to apply to the southern kingdom. And I will bring that out as we go along. So, without further ado, let's jump into the text. The word of the Lord that came to Micah of Moresheth during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, the vision he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. So here it is. Hear, you peoples, all of you, listen, earth, and all who live in it, that the sovereign Lord may bear witness against you, the Lord, from his holy temple. Look, the Lord is coming from his dwelling place. He comes down and treads on the height of the earth. The mountains melt before him. The valleys split apart like wax before the fire, like water rushing down a slope. At this point, you've got to understand that Micah's audience is cheering. They are cheering because God is going to come and bring justice and defeat his enemies. That's what they're thinking. And then this is what they hear. All of this is going to happen because of Jacob's transgression, because of the sins of the people of Israel. What is Jacob's transgression? Is it not the capital, Samaria? What's Judah's high place, their object of worship, idol worship? Is it not Jerusalem? Yeah, God's going to judge his enemies, and they're about to find out, they are currently finding out, that his enemies have become his people, or his people have become his enemies. God says, therefore, I will turn Samaria into a heap of rubble, a place for planting vineyards. I will pour her stones into the valley, lay bare her foundations. All her idols will be broken to pieces. All her temple gifts will be burned with fire. I will destroy all of her pagan images. Since she gathered her gifts from the wages of prostitutes, as the wages of prostitutes, they will again be used. Prostitution was a metaphor the prophets used for idolatry, because idolatry, worshiping another god, is a form of adultery. That's why they used that metaphor. And the prophet Micah here is talking about the fact that Samaria, northern kingdom up here, is going to be destroyed. That happened very soon after he announced it. It happened in the year 722 BC. Assyria came in, and they absolutely destroyed the northern kingdom. They obliterated them. They were no more. They deported the people, destroyed the people. They repopulated the land. So northern kingdom destroyed, and Micah had predicted that. And he's not happy about it. So this is what he says next. He laments that that's going to happen. Because of this, I, Micah speaking, I will weep and wail. I will go about barefoot and naked. I will howl like a jackal and moan like an owl. For Samaria's plague is incurable. It has spread to Judah. It's gone south, right? Not just metaphorically, it's actually come south. It has reached the very gate of my people, even Jerusalem itself. Israel, northern kingdom, was always worse. They never had a single good king the entire time that kingdom was around, and they often influenced Judah to follow along with them. Judah ends up catching the disease that Israel had in the north, and it's probably very likely because they envied their wealth and power, and we'll get into that. Skip down to chapter 2, verse 1. Different tone here now. Woe to those who plan iniquity. Woe is a way of saying you are screwed. You don't have any hope left. Woe to those who plan iniquity, to those who plot evil on their beds. At morning's light, they carry it out because it is in their power to do it. They covet fields and seize them. They covet houses and take them. They defraud people of their homes and they rob them of their inheritance. This is an allusion to that story called Naboth's Vineyard that you can read about in 2 Kings. Wicked King Ahab and wicked Queen Jezebel, they steal a guy named Naboth, they steal his vineyard because the king basically wanted more land. And so they rob a poor guy, beat him up, kill him. Right? That's the allusion that Micah is referring to here. It happened about 100 years before Micah. Therefore, the Lord says, I am planning disaster against this people from which you cannot save yourselves. You will no longer walk proudly, for it will be a time of calamity. In other words, Judah, if you don't shape up and learn from Israel's mistakes, learn from the northern kingdom's mistakes, you're going to find you get the same result as them. God judged the northern kingdom for certain sins, right? Injustice, idolatry. If the southern kingdom starts practicing that, what choice does God have but to do the same thing to them? Skip down now to verse 12, and there is once again a change of tone. It's quite abrupt. Yahweh is again speaking. He says, I will surely gather all of you, Jacob. Now he's speaking about Judah, confusingly. I will surely bring together the remnant of Israel. This is once again talking about the southern kingdom. The remnant was a faithful minority. So among all the wicked people, we still have a few who are faithful. I will bring them together like sheep in a pen, like a flock in its pasture. The place will throng with people. Then the one, speaking of Yahweh, who breaks open the way will go up before them. They will break through the gates and go out. Their king will pass through before them, the Lord at their head. In other words, the Lord will be their shepherd king going forward. Let me give you a summary of what we have just read. The leaders are worshiping foreign gods, and they are oppressing their own people. And their prophets are taking bribes, and they are blessing these injustices that the leaders are performing. And God's patience is running out. And after Samaria is warned and then destroyed, when Judah doesn't learn from Samaria's, from Israel's mistakes, God's judgment is announced on the southern kingdom as well. Nevertheless, God promises at the end of the passage to shepherd a faithful remnant. That's our summary of our passage. Now let's unpack it a little bit more. Samaria and the northern kingdom were always envied by Judah, as I mentioned. The reason for that is that the northern kingdom was so much bigger and more powerful and more wealthy. They had 10 tribes up there, which means quite a few more people than the two tribes in the southern kingdom. Not only that, but they had better resources up there. The land was just way better. It produced a lot more resources, so they had a lot more wealth and a lot more power. And unfortunately, Judah always ends up envying them. When the split happened between the northern kingdom and the northern kingdom was then cut off from Jerusalem, which means that they needed to find their own way to worship Yahweh when they couldn't get down to the temple in south. In Jerusalem. And so what they do is those kings start setting up new places where they can worship. And God says, don't do that. And they did anyway. And then after they start worshiping Yahweh in the northern kingdom in ways that wouldn't have pleased God, they start worshiping other gods in the area as well. They paid lip service to Yahweh, but then they started worshiping other gods at the same time. But in spite of that, they had pretty easy lives. They had power and they had wealth. And it basically went pretty well for them most of the time. Now, they did have to sort of neglect and abuse the poor to maintain their standard of living, which is what Micah is going to get into. But they looked at themselves and said, we're pretty comfortable and we're pretty secure, so maybe God is blessing us. And most of the prophets, remember, there are a lot more prophets than what than are just those who were writing our scriptures. Okay? That was just a profession. So there were a lot of prophets at that time that were just blessing the leaders and telling them, good job, keep up the good work. God's blessing you guys. Worship your idols, go for it, so on. And so a lot of people were just doing their own thing. Now, I've been mentioning idol worship. We need to unpack that a little bit. We need to talk about the fact that idol worship and abusing the poor always go together. We can sometimes think that these people are silly because they worship idols. Right? Let me unpack why they worship idols. Olivia, would you go to the next slide, please? The safety and security slide, please, or the security and, what did I say, success slide. Idol worship is all about ensuring security and success, and they do it three ways. They do it through fertility first. The only way that you become a wealthy and successful and secure person in the ancient world is to get a lot of land, which means you need it to produce well. So that's all about fertility, your crops, your herds, and your children. Your children are your hired hands. They're your own security for further down the line. They end up being part of your army and so on. Fertility produces security and success. The gods of the ancient world were worshipped because they were thought to make the people and the land more fertile. Okay? That's what they're after. So they are after security and success. Secondly, the gods of the ancient world offer power. Whenever two armies go at it in the ancient world, the winner is always the winner because our God beat your God. That's always understood. So the gods are worshipped because they can once again offer security and success at the national level. Third, gods are all about control. And what I mean by that is more of the vending machine concept of control, where I put this in and I get that out as a result. The gods in the ancient world were absolutely never, ever worshipped for the sake of relationship. That's just a completely foreign concept to them. Yahweh is so utterly different from every other god in the ancient world. The gods are about power and control and fertility. So I offer my offering to this god, not because I want to get to know that god more or worship that god just for the sake of worshiping. It's so that I get something out of it. It is once again about security and success. Now do we understand why they worship idols? This is why they worship, because they want to, they're not secure, and they want to be secure. They want to ensure their future and look after their children, and they want to be safe. They want to be prosperous, and so on. Idol worship is all about power and control, safety, security, and success. So, we don't worship gods of gold in the same way, but we're still looking for security and success, aren't we? And there's one main idol that we all pay a fair amount of allegiance to in our culture, isn't there? What's the main way that we ensure our own future, our security, and our success? What is it? Money. You know that. Right? And so what we end up doing is we start making an idol out of all of the things that give us money to ensure our safety and our security and our success. Right? The economy, our jobs, we trust in our resume and our references, right? Our ability to make a living. Our investments, we essentially trust that my investments are going to grow and they're going to be there and they are going to be my safety and security in the future, right? The whole web of money, how we get it, how we save it, how we look after it, this is our idol. It's how we ensure our security and our success. It's probably not the only way, but it's certainly the biggest one in our particular culture. So we trust it. We sacrifice for it. We sacrifice to get ahead, to make more money, etc. We desire it. If you sacrifice and trust and desire, that's worship language, right? This is our idol. And the prophets are clear. When you worship something other than God, it's idolatry. Idolatry always leads to oppression. Idolatry always leads to oppression. Two reasons for that. One, because people are made in God's image. And so if we start worshiping something other than God, people don't matter as much. So we don't take care of them. Secondly, if we're worshiping money, and that's going to be our source of security and success, we will go after that and put it before the things that God says are most important. People. Idolatry always leads to oppression. We will put ourselves first at the expense of others. Now, the oppression that Micah was addressing at the time, it was very overt, right? The passage talks about how you're alluding to Naboth's vineyard, right? This, you are stealing from people. You are robbing the poor. You are oppressing them, right? You are defrauding people in order to line your own pockets, right? But for us, the way that we oppress the poor, and I will use that language, and the vulnerable, and I'm when I say we, first person, I'm included in this. I'm preaching to myself. We do it in two basic ways. Okay? We don't call it robbing. We call it saving and being frugal. So here's my punchline. Saving without giving is robbing. Saving without giving is robbing. If you don't believe me, see Malachi, where God says directly to the people, you have been robbing me. And they say, how have we been robbing you? And he says, because you haven't brought your gift to me. Saving without giving is robbing. Secondly, God builds it right into Old Testament practices and law that the poor are entitled to a portion of everyone else's income. You are not to harvest your field right to the very end. Anything that you drop is not yours to pick up. There are all those different things that get built into their system to make sure the poor are taken care of. In other words, what's yours, your field is not your field. Not all of it. What did I say here? Saving without giving is robbing. And we still do this. If we don't give. I am preaching to myself. Second way that we abuse the poor is just by neglect. Abuse or neglect is a form of abuse, isn't it? Think about the way some children are treated. Neglect is a form of abuse. And sometimes the vulnerable just don't come across our minds, right? Out of sight, out of mind. Neglect is a form of abuse. And I'm preaching to myself. Now, Judah followed Samaria in chasing after their idols, the idols that would give them security and success, the stuff that they wanted. And the prophet says, Samaria's plague is incurable, and it has now spread to Judah. And Micah says, if God punished the northern kingdom for this and judged them for it, he will do the same thing to you in the south. And the reason this is in our scriptures is because if it happened to them, it could very well happen to us. Not that we will be destroyed. It's not that close of a one-to-one. The one-to-one is God judged them. God will judge us. So, at the same time, there is this abrupt shift in the passage. And suddenly, at the end, God is comforting a remnant of people who have survived. There has been judgment, and some of them have passed through that judgment and survived. And he's comforting the faithful minority known as the remnant. And he's going to show them, if you look at these verses, that he is going to be their security and their success. Look at chapter 2, verse 12. I will surely gather all of you, Jacob. Now he's addressing Judah because the northern kingdom's been destroyed. I will surely gather all of you. I will surely bring together the remnant of Israel. I will bring them together like sheep in a pen, like a flock in its pasture. Skip down two lines. Their king will pass through before them, the Lord at their head. Olivia, would you go to the next slide, please? It's a picture. Thank you. It's a picture of a shepherd king looking after his faithful people. And it sounds like he is guarding them in a sheepfold, but he is going to lead them out and care for them. And he will be their hope and their security and their success. Our hope is not in money. Now this description of Yahweh sounds very, very much like Psalm 23. So as I read you Psalm 23, look at all of the security and success language in Psalm 23. Listen to it. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want money. He makes me lie down in green pastures, security. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my life. He leads me in right paths for his own sake. Security and success here. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil thing, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Security. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Success. Surely goodness and covenantal love shall pursue me all the days of my life, and I will live with Yahweh forever. Advent is about waiting for this good shepherd. Our hope is not in money. This is our hope. He is our hope. He is our security. He is our success. And as we remember that, and as we wait for him this Advent, may we not neglect him.